How you doing, bro?
What's good, man? How are you?
Amazing. Nice to meet you.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
No, it's my pleasure. It's like, honestly, like, the whole reason I do this is just amazing to get to meet people that I grew up on. So,
yeah,
man. Fantastic. But we got to talk about this. Like, last time that we saw each other, we were outside of a Detroit auto factory. Beefing outside the food truck. Actually, I thought it was kind of fucked up. You were making
Marshall. Well, you're like Partial Mathers.
You were making fun of some random woman who worked at the factory, and I had to intervene and stop you.
Oh, the joys of Halloween.
Hey, so wait, you don't dress up for Halloween anymore?
Nah, man. Nah, I've never dressed up for Halloween ever.
Right.
Well, partly because my parents were religious when I was a kid, and so I never did that. And then as I became an adult and went on my own, be able to make my own decisions, I just never saw the value in dressing up. Like, my son, like, I dressed up a couple times, don't get me wrong. Like, but I gotta go, like all the way. Like, I got a real stormtrooper outfit. So I look, right. And my son wanted to be Darth Vader one day.
Right.
So it was for one Halloween. So we did that, and I followed them around the neighborhood, and everybody thought it was great.
No,
but
no.
That was, like, one of the only times I ever dressed up.
I honestly haven't really dressed up since I was maybe like 12, 13. Over the years, you know, I might throw on a mask or something like that. But then this year, my girlfriend kind of pitched it to me as like, think about it. If you dress up like something crazy, it'll go viral. I'm like, you know, all right, right. Like, I see people go viral every Halloween and stuff off of like really creative costumes. Yeah. And then somebody suggested Eminem, and I'm like...
Got it to duh.
That's it.
There it is. Well, I think the kids got us beat. You know what I mean? Because I look online and I see all the kids with their costumes, and they little as fuck, so they can, you know, like, dress up in better costumes and it'd be more compact.
And as an adult, you just, like, you get so used to being comfortable. Like, even me right now, I'm like, man, I'm going to want to put a hoodie on, but I got this stupid paint all over me. I don't know. No. But so do you get into Halloween because of the kids? Because your kids are excited about it?
Nah, I mean, like, well, I feel like that about all holidays. You know, it's like, my favorite holiday is Thanksgiving because you don't have to buy people shit.
Yeah.
But it's basically, you know, for the kids, you know, Christmas, all that stuff. I just participate because they want to do it. You know?
Yeah.
Valentine's Day, you got to buy stuff for the wife.
I seen you with the kids at the Lakers game.
Yeah.
And they were super excited about it and going crazy. And it was just like cool to see you like really enjoying that from like your son's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the best things about my life is my family, you know? So I really, really cherish the time I have with them, and I work really hard to provide for them. So when I get to enjoy moments like that and be able to do things that, you know, I see fit, you know, it feels really good.
Do you think your kids necessary? Because there's always that struggle of like, if you are a person who's sort of made it in life and you're able to afford to have your kids courtside at the Lakers game, that they might not necessarily grow up with the same understanding of the struggle per se.
Oh, no, but they're not supposed to.
Right.
I mean, you're never supposed to, you know, start in the same place that your struggle that your parents had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're supposed to be able to let them start from different places and they have different problems. I never, you know, want my children to see the struggle that I saw because they may not make it out. So I was strong enough to get to the place where I did in order to create this lifestyle for them where they don't have to worry about getting shot at or, you know, socking people up every time they go home or getting socked up or, you know, or none of that. They don't have them problems, and I'm thankful for that.
But you ever look at your kids and you're like, man, like, is there ever a balance in your mind between having them grow up to be street smart to a certain extent and having them just actually be able to just avoid a lot of the bullshit that
I think street smart and book smart was made up by people who didn't get good grades. You know what I'm saying?
Or who weren't in the streets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm street smart and I'm book smart. You know, you can do both. You don't have to be an idiot out there, and just because you're an idiot, you can be tough.
Right.
It's no, you know, boundaries for that.
Right.
So I think that being street smart is about not getting yourself killed. And that's the basic principle. And being book smart will get you into doors that aren't open to people who don't have education. So I think there's a balance there too. And again, I don't want my sons out there, you know, shooting at people or getting socked out. And you know what I'm saying? Like, they supposed to have different problems. Now they know how to defend themselves to the T, But by no means do I want them to have the same kind of run-ins and the same kind of, you know, difficulties and enemies that I've had, you know? Because, again, they're not built like that. They're not supposed to be. You know, my dudes is college material. My dudes is boardroom material. They're not out here to be following no motherfucking gangs and selling no dope. You know what I'm saying? Because they don't come from that.
Yeah. Is watching your kids grow up, is that like enough that it makes you sort of want to take a step away from a lot of the bullshit that you were into as you were younger? Like, in terms of, you know, I've noticed that you haven't put out as much music over the past few years and stuff. Is that because you're just sort of fixated on enjoying the good life of just taking care of the kids? And I know you're acting and shit.
No, that's not why.
Oh, what's that related to?
No, I haven't put out music because I've been observing. And there's a disturbance in the force. I needed to know what it was. And I'm not going to call it disturbance because that gives it a negative connotation. I'm observing because I'm seeing the dynamics and the values and the principles behind hip-hop change, literally in front of us. And so what used to be desirable and acceptable is not desirable and acceptable anymore. It's like, I saw it started when people started saying, well, I don't give a fuck about the lyrics. I just like the beat. And when that changed, it was like, oh, okay, well, now the beat is the only thing they're listening to. You can say anything. So literally people started mumbling like they weren't saying anything. And then it was like, okay, well, let me see where this goes next.
But when did you start to really see that becoming a thing within hip hop?
I mean, it's just been ongoing. You know, music is universal and hip hop moves around. I mean, there was a time when New York had a lockdown hold on hip hop, and then the West Coast had a lockdown hip hop hold, and then the South has, you know, and continues to have a lockdown on hip hop, and now it's going into this hybrid of all three. And so now you're hearing records from New York that sound like they're from the South, and records from the West Coast that sound like they're from the South, and that's like people in the South sounding like they making pop records, and it's just a new dynamic. So I had to see where I fit in that scheme of things. I had to see where I fit because I don't want to mimic or imitate anything by anyone at any time. But I just need to do what I do very well.
Right.
And that's the distinct difference from what I see then and what I see now. I don't think I have to change. I have to really do what I do really well. And no fluff, no filler, no bullshit, no skits, no I don't know. There has to be a kick in the fucking teeth every time we put it out.
You think that's why you gravitate towards working with B-Real? Because he's like a dude who's been around for a long time and still manages to, like, you know, he still seems real passionate about actually getting in there and rapping, regardless of what might be the most popular shit going on at the time or whatever.
Yeah, I like B-Real because he's very consistent and he's very focused on what he has to do, and he doesn't go outside of that. And, you know, Cypress does festivals by the hundreds of thousands every year.
Right.
I mean, they have, like, scheduled. Their calendar's probably booked for the next fucking 5-10 years.
Yeah.
But these guys always reinvent themselves like Snoop does. Snoop is a genius at reinventing himself. I pride myself in being able to make decisions that take me out of what people perceive me as and be able to flourish in there, such as television, film, you know, reality, scripted, you name it. I've been able to go outside of what people think of Exhibit and been able to break that and been on, you know, things that you never would have thought you'd see me on.
Right. People probably wouldn't have seen you necessarily. Like I mean, I guess Pimp My Ride and all that was like your initial entry into acting, but you've gone way beyond that since. Yeah. And I guess, like, some people probably, like, even when I was going back and watching Pimp My Ride, like, there's a video of all of the intros of every time that you walked out.
Yeah.
That shit's fucking tight to watch crazy. 10 minutes of that straight.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. I mean, that was the entry. I don't think anybody expected that show to be what it was, you know. And then when we went from that, it became, okay, so let's do films. I started doing, my first film was with Ice Cube, XXX2. And then we went to, you know, all the way up to being just recently on Empire for 3 years.
Right. R.I.P.
Right.
To
man,
you.
Yeah.
No,
yeah, they did Shine Dirty, man. But it was cool, man, because I always challenge myself. I never am satisfied with what people perceive of me. I don't give a fuck. You know what I'm saying? I do what makes me feel comfortable and challenged. And that's where my creative curve stays on the edge. You know what I'm saying? Like, I want to be pushing myself to those limits and be able to do things. And when somebody sees the value in that and allows me to step into their production, man, I bring it 100% because that's what I love to do. I love to create things.
Right. So let's talk about Exhibit as a young man. Like, when you think back to what you were like in elementary school or junior high, was it clear to you that you were going to be this kind of creative person?
Nah, man. When I was a kid, you know, I wanted to be an architect.
Really?
Yeah. I wanted to build bridges and shit.
How'd you get that in your head?
Because, I mean, I used to... My parents didn't allow me to watch a lot of television, so we had to keep ourselves creative, you know what I'm saying, and keep ourselves entertained. So I would always, you know, draw stuff or build stuff out of the materials that I had. And well, I built a motherfucking a go-kart out of a shopping cart and a lawnmower engine. Like,
really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah, and we had to steer it with chains that we put on the front wheels to, like, turn it left and right.
That was the kind of shit that I was watching kids do in movies. But yeah, I wanted to do that kind
of
stuff.
Like some Spielberg shit.
Right,
And then me and my friends, we used to make up plays and, like, put them on in the garage. Like, all the kids come in and sit down. And then we sit in the garage, and my friend would do funny voices, and we do karate movies. Like, we would have people talking on the side of the garage. You can't see them, but just move our mouths, and everybody was laughing. Like, we did shit like that.
When you look back at that, you're like, oh, I was definitely meant to be a creative or entertainer. Like, I was doing stuff even before, but you didn't know that it was going to be rap.
No,
you were like
that.
Creating shit. You were putting shit together one way or another.
Yes, because we weren't sitting down in front of screens and whatnot, so we had to use our imaginations. But, you know, I think that, you know, it really built something else inside of us that kind of allowed us to view and see things in a deeper way.
Right.
And see the creativity in it, not just the message, you know?
Yeah. No, I've been thinking about that because I feel like whenever I get some free time, like I went to Palm Springs for 2 days with my girl, finally had some downtime, wasn't staring at my phone the whole time, I actually got to think driving. All of a sudden I get back and I'm like a million times more creative and I'm being nicer to everybody around me and I'm thinking better and stuff. And I forget how much it like weighs you down when you're just in the grind every day.
You get to collect your thoughts. Oh. You get to, you know, prioritize your thoughts, you know, because everything don't need to come first.
Exactly.
You know, you got to put things in perspective, put things in priority, and then you execute at that. You know, I like to be very organized. I think I got that from my dad. My dad was very he's very corporal. He came from the Marine Corps. So, you know, when my mother passed, he just like that was it. That was like he raised me the best way he could, and that was what he knew.
And your mom passed at what age?
At 9.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's all I knew was my pops, and that kind of structure. You know what I'm saying? That organization. And so I lived my whole life like that. It's very militant. It's very on the nose.
So you went from having, you know, a mothering influence in your life to then your dad taking care of you. And was he sort of like all the way on the other side?
Full metal jacket all the way down.
Really? Did he have you like running around the block every night doing 1,000 push-ups a day?
But my dad, man, rest in peace, man. My father just passed. And I love my father so much. He is my hero. He gave me everything as far as what I know as a man and my principles and what I stand for, I got from him. And so, you know, I was very rebellious as a kid because I was very angry. But at the same time, he wasn't getting out of my way and he wasn't getting out of my face.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the whoopings didn't work, when, you know, all the other shit didn't work, he got creative. So my father was cold, man. He, like, we got out of school, and I had been fucking up really bad. And so I get home. He tells me to get out of my clothes and put on some work clothes because, you know, we got to do chores and shit around the house. So we go in the backyard, and this dude went and got a pile of gravel about as high as this fucking ceiling. Right? Just in the backyard. Biggest big pile of motherfucking rocks. And he put it on one side of the yard and he said, okay, he gave me a shovel, he gave me a wheelbarrow. This is your summer. You're gonna move this pile of rocks from this place and put it over there on the other side of the yard.
Totally senseless.
There was no fucking purpose whatsoever of what I was doing this for, except that this is going to be a punishment that, because I'm not going to whoop your ass. I'm not going to put hands on you. This is going to be psychological. Mm-hmm. So every day at 4 a.m., you have to get up and start hitting this pile. And you're going to hit the, you're going to do this. You're going to have a lunch break, and you're going to move this pile until it's time to go to bed at 6, 7 o'clock. Then you're going to get up at 4 a.m. again until this whole rock pile is moved.
And was this the type of thing that he was prone to do, or was this just one specific?
This was some new shit. He made this shit up on the spot, I think. But I think he was so mad at me that he was either that or kill me. Mm. So he's like, fuck, I don't want to go to jail. So let me go get these rocks.
how bad were you fucking up that he even considered something like this?
Yo, my dad was very creative when it came to discipline, man. Uh-huh. But, you know, but it sounds harsh, but at the same time, he loved me. Mm. And he knew the kind of person and the direction that I could go. Either you can use your powers for good or evil. It sounds like some comic book shit, but that's what it could have been. I could have been a really smart criminal. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Or I could have been a really smart businessman. He was pushing me towards being the businessman, and he didn't want to damage our relationship any more than he had. Mm. You know what I'm saying? By being as harsh as he was.
It's weird because you go through your whole childhood in a certain way. You can't really relate to your father and what he was going through when in terms of the way he disciplined you or the way he treats you. But then you get older and you start to see how hard the struggle of what he was going through was and how much stress he was under having to deal. I'm assuming our parents were going through somewhat similar things around like high school. Because, you know, with my dad, it's like, yeah, he was beating the shit out of me and everything. But like in retrospect, this is a guy who was just trying to raise a family off a regular salary.
But that's how they got treated.
True.
Right. That's how they were taught. That's how they learned. So my job is to not relive the sins of my father. Mm-hmm. And so even though I went through that with him, by the end of our relationship and in his passing, we have become very close. And we have become very, you know, bonded together through the birth of my children mm-hmm. and him being a grandfather and seeing them. And, you know, seeing me as a man, as a father, as an entertainer, he got to see all these things happen. He got to see all the plaques. He got to see the tours. And he was very proud. Like he said on several occasions, how proud he was of me of not having to come to a prison or funeral, or graveyard to see me, you know, and that I had turned my negatives into positives. So I'm glad we had that relationship, man. And I take all the good from him and put it into the way I raise my children now. So no, we don't have them problems. You know, I don't use corporal punishment on my children. You know, I think I could talk to them to a place where, okay, so if we're going to get to a place where you feel like you can disrespect me, I got some boxing gloves. Mm. You know what I'm saying? We can see what's popping. But for the most part, man, my children respect me very much and respect my words. They respect my opinion.
Yeah. That's got to be a fucking struggle, though, because sometimes I feel like, you know, because the way I grew up, I would never want to lay hands on my kid if I had one or when I have one, presumably. presumably, I'm not going to be able to hold it in my whole life. But, you know, like sometimes you ever feel like you've been pushed to that point where you almost want to do something that goes beyond just words.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, you have to get to a point where all other options are exhausted. Mm.
All right. Today's podcast is brought to you by Eagle Energy. Eagle Energy is a caffeine inhaler. It's quick, simple, and it's a healthy energy boost on the go. If you hit the Eagle Energy pen, Eagle Energy will hit you in 3 to 5 minutes versus the 30 to 40 minutes that it takes coffee or an energy drink to take effect. Eagle Energy uses plant-based caffeine and plant-based flavor additives. There's no sugar and no crash. When you inhale caffeine, it's metabolized rapidly and will not stay in your system for hours like coffee or an energy drink. A lot of pro athletes and artists are already using these things, and they're loving these. Why? Because they're high-performing individuals. So they need something like this that will help them to stay on top. I use it, and it definitely helps me stay sharp and focused when I'm making videos, doing interviews, all that. So I would suggest that you head on over to www.eagle.energy and use the code NOJUMPER22 to get 22% off your order. This is coming straight to you from Adam22, not a famous rapper that I might appear like at this moment. Eagle Energy, and the website again is www.eagle.energy. The link is going to be in the description, and use the code NOJUMPER22. Find out what it's all about Appreciate you guys supporting the sponsors of the show. Let's get back into the interview.
You have to get to a point where everything else is exhausted. And then it's like it has to be age appropriate. You know, for my oldest son, you know, we had our tiffs, you know what I'm saying? And then one day the gloves did come out.
Right.
You know, and I was like, okay. you think you can do this? Right. Okay, well, here you go.
I remember I woke up around 17 and I realized that my dad couldn't really hit me anymore because I could fuck him up. But I feel like you're kind of a big guy. Like, your kid might have to be a little bit older before he can fuck you up.
Yeah. You know, I'll be like, yo, man, nigga, you came out of my dick, nigga. You'll never beat me up. I will beat your ass. Nigga, I don't give a fuck how big you get. I will knock you out.
Yeah. I might have to go get a sword or something. Let's make this an unfair fight. All right, but so what was your relationship to hip hop growing up, all through high school and stuff? Was that your soundtrack to you misbehaving?
Yeah. No, actually, it wasn't even about there was no correlation between my love of hip hop and my behavior, because my behavior was brought on by a whole lot of traumatic events in a very short amount of time. But my love for hip hop was one of the outlets that saved me. It was like one of the only things that I could escape with, you know. So I would listen to the music, I would imitate the music, I would put on my brother's Kango with no shirt on and rap LL Cool J lyrics and, like, I would do all that. I was a fan of everything, and so I would listen to it, and I was able to find the artistic value in it, and it just drew me in. And so once they found out, you know, that I was in love with hip hop, then it was, of course, it was unacceptable. You know what I'm saying? So, the next best thing to listening to it is creating it. Mm-hmm. So I started writing at 13 years old, like Exhibit A. That was my first rap name, you know? And then after Exhibit, I would rap on KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you know, because my dad got remarried and we lived out there for like 7 years. And so I would rap on the
So you started in Detroit, then Albuquerque, then L.A.?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Detroit till what age?
Nine.
Nine. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Then I came out to L.A. when I was like 17, 18 years old.
Just ready to get into fuck shit.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting you say fuck shit because I was a father at 20.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's serious. Oh, so your oldest kid is much, much older. I got you. Yeah, right.
He's like 23, man.
Oh, wow. Know? So maybe he could fuck you up. I don't know. Nah. He could be pretty big at 23.
No, man.
You can't risk
we're
him
past
seeing
that,
this.
Man. We're past that. He's trying to get a pay per view with my kids.
Man, there's a lot of money in that.
No, man.
Wait, he's 23. So what's he into? What kind of kid is he?
Oh, man. Tremaine is fantastic, man. I love my sons. Tremaine is 23 and his brother is 8.
Okay.
You know, and Tremaine has been working on his own projects, his own career. He wants to do music. He didn't want to go to college, so I supported that. As I said, you have to work. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to keep yourself busy. So Trey Capital is his rap name.
Okay.
And you know, I observe from the distance, man. I want him to want to do this, not because it's handed to him, it's because he earned it.
Right.
And I support him, all that. And he has his own lane. He works with Wonder Girl and a whole bunch of other cats that, you know, he runs with. And I'm very proud of him, man. He came out, you know, the way I expected him to. He's a responsible part of society, and he's not out here doing nothing wild to nobody's kids. And you know, he's amazing. You know, he's very thoughtful. He's very, you know, insightful. And he comes and has conversations with me. You know, it's like, I remember when I was a kid, I wouldn't go see my dad as often. And I get it. I know that part. But now that I'm the father and he's not coming around as much as he used to.
Really?
It's kind of like, oh, shit. Now I know how that feels. And, I'll catch myself being like, no, how come you ain't calling me? And I'll be like, oh, shit, I'm my dad right now. You know what I'm saying? Like, but it's dope.
That's good, though, just to be able to remind him. To even be able to have that relationship where you could hit him up and be like, what the fuck? Come on. Talk to your pops. What's up?
What are you doing? Yeah, what's going on? But I just spoke to him this morning, man. But, you know, Trey's doing really well.
Right. Yeah. So you were actually recording and stuff while you were in Albuquerque, or did that start once you moved to L.A.?
No. I was just hanging out in Albuquerque. I was actually didn't start recording until I came to California.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you moved to L.A., where did you move to? And did you just get wrapped up in the whole scene or what?
When I first got to L.A., it was back when I got here, there was no cell phones going down. I had a pager, right?
Okay.
And so I had a contact of a guy named Jay Johnson who lived in Duarte, California. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me his number, his pager number, and said if I'm ever in California, hit him up. He had his own place, mm-hmm. right? So long story short, I come to L.A. He's not answering the phone whatsoever or the pager. So I go to Venice Beach. My first night in California, I spent homeless on Venice Beach.
So you moved right? out here. It wasn't your family moving out here.
No,
it's
by myself. Right. I had a black and purple Geo Tracker, $3,000, some cross-color clothes, a Cool G Rap, DJ Polo CD, some Snapples, and an AK-47. And so I had all that shit, and I drove to Venice, and I was like, you know, he didn't call me back till the next day. So finally calls me back. He's like, who is this? I'm like, man, like, nigga, it's me. I'm out here. You just say, oh, shit. Well, you know, where you at? I'm like, nigga, I'm out in Venice Beach. I need to come with you. I got all this shit in the car, man. Let's go. I'm coming out here. Uh-huh. And then he was like, oh, man, I live with my parents. What the fuck are you talking about? You live with your fucking parents.
Right.
Nigga, I got, you know how much shit I got with me, my nigga? Like, and he's like, okay, cool. Well, just come by. Let's just come by. So I drove out to Duarte, and I kicked it with his family. I told him what I was up against. I didn't tell him about the AK because right. that would have been a deal breaker.
So did that seem like a big deal to you that you were driving across all these state lines with a machine gun in the trunk?
No, because where I was coming from, that was pretty much regular shit.
Right.
Yeah.
Pretty illegal in L.A., though, even at the time, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, Solo was selling crack, and I was doing that, too. I mean, you got to pick and choose your battles.
What age did you start doing that? Because I might need some crack later. I was wondering if you're still in the business.
No, we put that down quite some time ago.
Okay.
Well, you know, but I was a kid, man. I was a teenager. You know what I'm saying? Right. It was like, everybody thought that was the way out.
Isn't that crazy to think that those choices that you made back then, though?
Could have got me killed.
If you had got caught up in the right situation, you could have gone to jail for 20 years.
Yeah, done. Done.
You'd be getting out around now.
Yeah, I'm very thankful for... whatever guardian angels or forces that have been watching and guiding my steps through these years, because I learned a lot, I changed a lot, and I've turned my life in so many different directions. Like, it's hard to look back and fathom that I survived the shit I did.
For real.
You know. So yeah, that's where it came from.
But so you move in with this guy for a period of time, and
just for a few weeks. I gave him the $3,000 I had.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a bunch of people. I mean, when you come from selling dope, you know who sell dope.
Uh-huh.
So you could look around and be like, oh, that's the plug.
Right.
So immediately when I got here, shit was hard. Once that $3,000 was gone, I was like, fuck, I need to make a bag.
Uh-huh.
And the people that were around me would not allow me to get involved in that here.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It was like, nah, man, you on the path to do something else.
I bet, especially being from out of town, coming to L.A.
Yeah, they was like, nah, we ain't going to throw you in the mix like that, but you can't get with this person who does this or this person who does that. And then they was always pushing me to go with the music people, and I eventually got out with James Broadway and 360. It was a group in Pasadena. And by that time, I was out on, out, found a clique to roll with and kind of like merged in with them.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's how I started. Met King T and the Alcoholics from the 360 clique. And, you know, and one thing happened after another and ended up, you know, having a career from it.
Right. So what was the one song, the first hit that you had? Or the first song that put you on the mark? Or on the
Paparazzi.
Map? Right, right. But that got you signed.
There was no... The song that got me signed was on King T's album. It was called Freestyle Ghetto.
Okay.
And I never made a demo. I never made a mixtape. They didn't exist at the time. It was kind of like just word of mouth. Like, I was going around L.A. like eating MCs alive.
Really?
Yeah. And it was like these battles and shit that I would just go to. And, you know, we just go to Unity and, you know, Bigger B, rest in peace, in Orlando used to throw this joint called Unity back in the day. And David Faustino used to have this club called Ballistics we used to frequent, you know. But it was all MC-based. L.A. had a really dope MC scene at the time. And so everybody was clicked up and going around trying to see who had the business, you know.
Yeah, given, like, the current rap scene, it's kind of almost hard to imagine that that being like the thing that brings like LA rappers together is like having events where people are actually rapping to figure out who's the best. Like that, I think the world could use more of that, like more actual rapping to bring like the scene together. I feel like the battle rap thing could make a comeback and shit. Cause
but it wasn't necessarily battling each other. It was kind of like, that was the, like, Unity was the first place I got to see Wu-Tang, and Old Dirty Bastard used to do a lot of solo shows there. First place I got to saw Redman and Method Man, because he would bring all these dope MCs and bands out to play Unity, and all the local MCs would be able to get on the opening bill. So that's where I cut my teeth, and that's how I got introduced to the LA market.
Hell yeah. So was it ever weird just because you weren't originally from there? Did you feel like you had some growing pains in terms of, because like, especially like by the time you were really out there in like the late 90s, early 2000s, it was like your image and shit was very much like that. You were like the quintessential LA dude with the hair, the outfits, everything. You just looked like the hardest South Central cat, period. Was it, was it kind of a weird thing because you weren't originally from LA?
No, I mean, I think that has nothing to do with the representation of what we were doing, because if you look at it, you know, Nate Dogg's from Mississippi.
Oh, really?
You know, Corrupt is from Philly. You know, all these different places, you know, like these people came from in order to represent something bigger than themselves. And that's why I felt comfortable doing that, because when I got here, I was like, you know, we'll put it this way. It's people that was born here all their life and still never got where I got to.
Facts.
So, you know, fuck that.
Facts. So your first album, though, was not with Dre. Was it after that, your second album? Or
no,
third?
My third album was with Dre.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how did you, like, even get to the point where you started to get into the ear of, like, you know, top level people in LA? Because it's like, from the sounds of it, you were just like coming out here and just trying to meet people, just trying to make something happen, try to figure out what's going on. But then all of a sudden you're in the studio with like the biggest names in LA. That's kind of like a crazy trajectory to navigate.
Right. I mean, it was like, I just relied strictly on skill and being able to go out and make records and adapt to what was happening. And I was always a writer. You know, my mother was a writer. That's where I got it from. And she was also an English teacher. So my vocabulary was big enough, but I just didn't have the style or the structure of writing songs down. When I mastered that, I was able to sharpen what I was doing and able to connect and send messages better than I had in the past. It was very broken messaging back when I was first starting, but then as I got better and better with songwriting, I was able to structure songs and make complete songs,
right?
And then able to mature into making hit songs, you know. And I think that's where that maturity kind of met the momentum on my third album, where Dre stepped in. It was like the perfect storm. It was the Up in Smoke tour. It was, you know, the Chronic 2001. It was after Bitch Please. It was like, this was a really big transition in my whole career at that time. And so then when Restless came out, that's when it just exploded.
Right. So, yeah, it is kind of crazy to think that that was sort of how you were presented, is that you were like this gangster rapper, but also like super technical lyrically. Like that was sort of like the proposition behind like Exhibit at that time, was like that you were sort of, cause like, you know, he was sort of coming off of Eminem and shit, but it was kind of like, you know, like this is this other dude who can rap his ass off too. And it was sort of like, man, that's crazy to even think about that time period and just how much energy there was behind the whole West Coast or the whole aftermath in general.
Yeah. Hell yeah, man. I look back at those times and I just see how powerful we were. And we didn't understand what we were doing at the time. We were just having fun.
Right.
You know, just banging the fucking tracks out. You know what I'm saying? And lo and behold, you know, they've turned into classics, and, you know, and megastars have been born. And, you know, I'm just very proud to be a part of that movement.
Right. So you were on the whole Up in Smoke tour?
Absolutely.
Can we talk about what that was like? Or what? That's one of the most legendary tours in the history of hip-hop. And sometimes I wonder why we don't have tours that seem as massive as that. Maybe it was the movie that they made about it that made it seem so much bigger.
No, it was massive.
Yeah.
The movie didn't do it justice.
Really?
Yeah, no, but I mean, fuck, dude. I mean, I think it was the first of its kind to go out with that many stars and have no hiccups and have no cancellations. And everybody is, you know, is pushing for the same cause. And it was dope, man, to go out there and be part of that, man. And Nate Dogg and Ice Cube and Eminem and Warren G, Snoop and Dre, of course. I mean, all those mega stars just out there just killing it, man, across the whole country. And we did it with no flaws. And Dre was definitely the mastermind behind all of that and making it work and how it was presented. And I learned a lot about my touring experiences and what to expect from, you know, pushing out a project.
So there was really like very few hiccups, very few like problems between the whole crew and everything. Cause I think that's like the assumption is that if you put like 10 really popular rappers on a rap tour together in close quarters, that there's just going to end up being issues.
Nah, but see, that maybe with rappers, that's the case, but we was family.
It really felt like that.
Yeah, yeah. We was family. We was out there like really like holding each other down and looking out for each other. So when we came off of that tour, it was all camaraderie, and we came and made some really dope music after that too.
Right. Yeah. So you recorded the Chronic 2001 right before that tour?
Yeah. The album came out first, and then we went out on tour, and then after that I came home and put out Restless.
Right, yeah. So making that project though, like did it seem obvious to you how massive of a project this was going to be, because it had been, you know, how many years, maybe 3-4 years since, yeah. Or even longer than
that. I knew it was different. I knew it was bigger. I had put 2 albums out on Loud Records, you know, before Restless, and, you know, I had some success with those. But I could tell the momentum had changed and the pendulum had shifted, and we ended up going out and smashing, man. We just that shit came out and it was crazy. You know? It was good to have that much attention. I'm glad that the windfall of success didn't happen at that time, because I was a little unhinged. So I think that if I would have been all the way financially in, you know, and I obviously wasn't ready for it. I think I would have really did some damage to myself, because I was like flying high. You know what I'm saying?
What do you mean by that? Like you were unhinged in the sense that
there was no control. It was like, you know, fucking Animal House. You know what I'm saying?
In terms of
like,
what? Partying,
bitches, drinking, fucking driving cars really fast, fucking, you know, you name it. Right. We did everything except skydive naked. You know what I'm saying? It's like, we did every fucking thing.
So you're saying by the time your first album on Aftermath came out, had you already
I was never signed on Aftermath.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was never. Dre always came and did my production wherever I was signed.
Oh, okay.
So I was on Loud Records. Loud Records got absorbed into Sony, Columbia, and then he produced over there for me too.
Oh, wow.
So he really showed a lot of love for me, being that I was the only artist that was never signed to him, but he came across the street and actually did full-blown executive production for me.
Right, yeah, he doesn't normally do that. Everybody works
for him. I'm the only one he does it for.
Wow.
Or he did it for.
But so by the time that started to happen, you started to really become like a household name. Had you already started to like grow up a significant amount in the sense of like not wanting to completely party your ass off all the time, or were you still kind of?
No, it had to crash. Yeah. It had to crash before it got better.
Okay. So what was the crash?
It was never a complete crash in front of anyone. Because once the problem started with me, Pimp My Ride came out.
Mm.
And then Pimp My Ride elevated it to a whole nother thing. So it was a different type of exposure. But behind the scenes, which I was taught never to bring your personal life to the office.
Mm-hmm.
So people would have never known that I was going through turbulent shit behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of financial trouble. I had a lot of personal troubles. I had a lot of relationship issues that were getting played out in the public. And one thing's getting out of control, 2 things out of control, 3 things spiraling out of control, and it all just went to shit. So I spent like maybe about a good 5 to 10 years really struggling with that. I got married in that time. My wife and I had a child die. You know, is born prematurely. And I was really at a point where I was very depressed and I was very closed in. And I felt like the whole world was against me. People are making fun of me. People think this is funny. This is not somewhere where I want to be. And I don't feel like talking or explaining myself to anyone. Mm. So after the cycle of that, when you stew in your own shit, it'll keep you there and it won't let you go. Mm. You have to make a decision in order to say, like, okay, I've had enough of this.
Right.
So now what do I do? So I broke it all the way down. I fired everybody that I was working with at the time.
Around what time, what year or so?
This was about 5 years ago, six years ago. I was just like, fuck this.
Because you had sort of a period in between, sort of like where you were really riding a high career-wise, and then like where you sort of like decided to sort of restructure yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And it was not because it was like, okay, I need to be in the limelight. No, I was unhappy. And I had to step away from all of it and make the adjustments to make myself happy.
Right.
Because if I'm not happy, then no one around me is going to be. Mm-hmm. So I had to go fix myself. And once I did that, I was like, okay, all you motherfuckers are fired. All right? So let's start from ground one. And if there's something that I don't understand, put it in front of me and let me figure this out and explain it to me until I totally understand it before I could take another step. Mm. So enough of this fucking going and hiring people when you don't understand what to do. Because half of having experience is knowing who to fire.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I had to go learn all of these things that I had not been paying attention to before, which is part of being a businessman.
Right.
So it's the music business. You have to have both. You can't just be a great musician and a half-assed businessman. You got to be just as dope in business as you are in music. So I had to go make that adjustment. Once I made that adjustment, I hired on new people. I brought in the people that I knew could execute, and we started from there. Right. You know, we went and the first thing was I wanted to become financially sound.
Right.
And
was it the tax shit that was the number one thing that was fucking you up?
After 10 years of penalties and what do you call it? Penalties and interest.
Right.
That shit adds up. All right. So I was under a $1.6 million tax bill on top of, you know, $300 to the state. And nobody taught me about money. I'm the first millionaire in my family that I can recall. And
It was one before you, you'd probably know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So we created this cannabis company called Brass Knuckles.
Right. Oh, so that was part of you sort of like.
Yeah.
And that was all the way back in like 2012, 13?
Yeah, yeah. It was about 3-4 years ago.
Right.
So I created this thing with two friends of mine. We was in my studio and we were, you know, definitely dealing with our own issues and like, you know what, we can do this shit.
Right.
We can do this shit. And, you know, I went outside and was like, well, what are we going to call it? I was like, well, let's call it Brass Knuckles because we want to knock people the fuck out. You know what I'm saying?
Classic brand name, yeah.
Right. And so we created this brand and we started with a very small amount and we just grew it and grew it and grew it. And then this turned into this thing. And it was like, it was very, it was amazing to see the power of the brand, how it started. Mm. And, you know, we built it. There's other brands out there that we view as premium as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Heavy Hitters, you look at Kingpin, 17 Kingpin, you look at Select, you look at all these other, I mean, Burner's doing really well. We have all these people in our community that are doing really good things with their brand. Mm. And so being part of that was very gratifying for us. And so we went out there with, you know, the intention of putting a really premium card on the market and the people spoke and they love it. And, you know, we've grown leaps and bounds. There's been some issues, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like counterfeiting issues and that leads to other things and whatnot. But all in all, the brand is intact, and, you know, as it goes through these transitions and whatnot, it's taught me a lot about another side of business that I, you know, learned a lot with, you know? So being financially stable was accomplished with that.
Right.
And so then it was like, okay, cool. So I went back and I paid all my taxes. I paid everything off. You know what I'm saying? It was like a really good feeling to get all of that off of me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And so then it gave me the creative freedom to, because nothing is worse than when you lie to yourself.
Right.
It gave me the creative freedom to go back into the studio and do the music that I feel can come from my soul. Mm. because I'm telling the truth. I'm not in here just, my life sucks, but I'm in here writing these tough ass raps.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Is that what kept you out of the studio for a long time?
Absolutely.
You didn't feel that confidence.
Absolutely.
Right. That makes sense, man.
Absolutely. Why am I going to go in there and say that I feel on top of the world when I don't? That's the fucking lie.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed away from that. I just, you know, I was like, let me work on me, because when it's time for me to go back in there and speak what's happening, then I'm going to make sure that when I go and turn that fucking mic on, that this shit is fucking Ringling Brothers out here.
In 2013, when you started the cannabis business, though, did you see the legalization movement moving as quickly as it has?
I got some really savvy people around me. Mm. We really looked forward to what the laws and the legislation was going to be.
Mm.
And along with a lot of other people out here, that you know, things change every day. But we are determined to stay in regulation, and we're determined to stay with everybody else is trying to stay in regulation, and we do better together than we do apart.
Mm.
So, you know, like I said, we are on to everything that comes out, and staying compliant is one of our main goals, and we do everything to stay within that box. And it's rough at times, because there's a lot of rogue shops that are still doing that thing, and they, you don't give a fuck about the regulations, you know. So,
but those dirty shops are going to go away within the next couple of years, right?
Eventually, but in the meantime, you know, a lot of the revenue still goes through there. So
do you guys primarily sell to legal shops out here?
No, we only sell to legal shops.
Okay,
yeah, we're only in California and we're in Nevada, and we have protective measures to try to counter, you know, trying to counter the counterfeiters.
Mm.
But we're taking measures to do that even more, you know. So we really enjoy the people that come in and engage with us and be part of this whole movement. So with that being said, you know, it was able, that door opened and was able to open other doors. So we were able to relaunch the label Open Bar Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to clean up whatever mess was made there, and then just kind of streamline everything, man, and betting on myself, you know. It was very... It was scary for my representation, because they were like, what the fuck do you mean you don't want to do this anymore? You don't want to do that anymore. I was like, listen, guys, this is what I want to do. If you're with me, then just trust me, because it's going to be big. And it turned out to be true.
Yeah. That's crazy, man. Just because it's such a competitive marketplace at this point, too. There's so much fucking weed stuff out there. But, I mean, you see, like, Brass Knuckles, like, even outside of, like, there's a lot of people who know about the brand that might not even necessarily know or be thinking about the fact that you're involved, which really says a lot. Because normally, you know, with weed brands, it's like, you associate them with the people who founded them when it's coming from a rapper or something like that. You know?
No, but it was one of the most important things when we were coming with the marketing for it, that it didn't say anything about
Exhibits weed.
No. Oh, fuck that.
That's kind of short sighted.
No, that's very 90-ish. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It was like everybody had to put their name or brand in front of whatever they were trying to do. But my idea behind the mission statement with Brass was to make the Brass brand the star.
Mm.
You know, it's not about who individually is behind it. It's about what it represents. It's a lifestyle.
Mm.
So that was the main focus on the way we went to market with Brass Knuckles.
You ever hit some of the Brass Knuckles on?
No, man. Last time I punched somebody, it cost me 30 racks.
Really?
I'm over that shit.
When was that?
Now I just hire people to do it now.
Yeah, that's illegal too, I think. Wait, when did you have to pay 30 racks for punching somebody? Like a long time ago?
That was a long time ago, man. Right. Yeah.
Brass Knuckles are illegal too. You can get all kinds of trouble.
I know.
For
you can't have them here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't.
I don't think
them
anywhere in the United States you can.
Now there's some place, man. Oh, really? Some place you gotta, you know, if they got bump stocks somewhere, then you can have Brass Knuckles.
Right. That's true. I mean, Brass Knuckles are scary because like you put them on and you kind of tap your hand against a wall or something. Yeah. You're like, holy shit, this could really fuck somebody up.
Knock somebody's teeth out.
Yeah. That's funny that it's like that. It's a weed product named after a item of self-defense that you can't legally have in this state.
Yes,
but
yes,
now
yes.
The weed is a lot more legal than the actual weapon, which is.
But I mean, I like it, man. I thought it was very edgy. It was kind of like it sounded strong, and yeah, man, it was like it lit the room up. So when the idea lights the room up, then you pretty much know you got something.
What is your personal history with marijuana, because Burner, like when we look at him, it's like he's somebody who clearly was involved with weed for a very long time on more of a less legal level. Yeah. Talks about that pretty openly in his music and stuff. What was your relationship with it, both as a user, and were you ever involved in the marijuana business before it was a legal business?
No, marijuana sold too slow for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that crack money's a lot better than weed money, right?
You're goddamn right.
Different profits.
It was consumption for me. I smoked my first joint in high school, mm-hmm. In the Cibola High School parking lot with my friend Richard Harvey, mm-hmm. and I forget the name of my man. Damn, man, he's gonna kill me. But it was stress. It was stress weed.
I wish we could go back in time and see the weed that we were smoking in the 90s.
It was boo-boo garbage trash. It was doo-doo stank. And it had seeds in it. And I was like, damn, this shit ain't high. I ain't getting high. I don't feel nothing.
Right.
It wasn't until like my second time actually smoking some weed that, I was like, oh, I've done that before. I can. And then somebody had some good weed, and that I was like, oh, shit, okay, here we go.
Right.
Yeah.
In retrospect, on something like the Up and Smoke tour, how much weed was really getting smoked every day? Was it ridiculous, even compared to today's standards?
Man, I'll put it like this. We had weed dealers traveling with us. Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like people with pounds just like flying in, and then they would be gone, and then they have to fly in some more and fly in some more. It was literally Up and Smoke.
Right. Are you into the edibles or anything like that? No.
Nah, I fell in love with blunts, man. I used to roll Philly blunts and the Garcia Vegas, and then I graduated to Backwoods, and I just been on Backwoods.
You're on the Backwoods now?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
For some reason, like, the Backwoods thing, I know it's not new, but it feels kind of like, I went in Joe Budden's office space fairly recently and saw that there's a pack of Backwoods right there, and I'm like, you smoke those?
Yeah.
I was just surprised. Like, it just seems like he's a New York guy. He's, like, a little bit older. He probably wouldn't be smoking Backwoods. He seemed really weirded out that I was surprised.
Yeah. He's like, don't you?
He's like, isn't that normal? I'm like, yeah, it is normal. I just didn't know you were on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been smoking Backwoods since we started doing, before the Strong Arm Steady, movement. We really took it there, though, but.
That's good. When I think about it, I've only been on them for like 4 years.
Yeah,
I'm trying to get off them.
I know, right? Lung busters.
For real, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're a lot more brutal on your throat.
I like smoking Backwoods because I know how to roll them really well. Mm.
Really?
And I like, of course, the taste and what it does with the marijuana. But I suck at rolling joints.
Oh.
And I hate the pre-rolls.
Right.
Like, it's like, I just can't fuck with it. You know what I'm saying? And if I was better at rolling joints, because that's part of the satisfaction I get from smoking, is the whole process, is breaking it down, rolling it up, having that little moment, and then the hit.
I know it's stupid, but when I see, like, because we're used to rolling these big ass Backwoods, and then I see somebody smoking a tiny little joint.
Yeah.
You know the Nick and Nate Diaz, the UFC fighters?
Yeah.
I just recently sort of got in touch with them, and I'm watching them on their Instagram story smoking these tiny joints, and I'm like, you guys are like the hardest motherfuckers in the world.
Yeah. Well, they need their cardio to stay up.
Exactly.
Punch people in the face for a living, so.
Yeah, I think the Backwoods are the enemy of athleticism, right?
Yeah.
I feel that. Every time I do cardio, I'm just like, what the fuck is this shit doing to me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, thank God I haven't done cardio in a while.
You don't have a strong exercise routine going on?
Well, I used to, but I've been taking time off, and I've been doing a whole lot of like business stuff. So I've been in boardrooms and tables and dinners, and so I'm not missing no meals, that's for sure. Yeah. But I have to get ready for next year, so I am going to go work through the holidays on the gut.
Yeah. Tough, man. It's tough to balance the two. But I feel like when you can balance the two, getting like that morning workout and then going and doing meetings all day, it's like you feel supercharged for those meetings, you know?
Oh, man, I hope so.
I know. I'm capping right now because that has not been me as of late. Yeah. But if I was, actually, I would probably fuck up this Eminem costume because I would look a little too buff to be Eminem. So. Yeah, in terms of, so how did you actually become super tight with B-Real is a good question.
Me and B-Real not only have, just interaction just through industry and being a big fan of Cypress Hill and Sin Dog and Muggs and Julio G, Fred Rack, all the, you know, the whole camp over there, Soul Assassins. But then we had a studio together in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be Fleetwood Mac's old studio.
Wow.
And I shared it with him for a while. Then he built a compound downtown, and I took over that studio. And in that time, you know, it was really close to both of our houses.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to go to that studio and work on his stuff and my stuff. And eventually that's where the whole idea of making Serial Killers came from.
Mm.
Yeah.
So Serial Killers from the beginning was just you and him, or was this other guy, Demrick, too?
No, Demrick was there. Demrick was kind of like under B. Real's wing. And okay. he brought him in, and, you know, he started touring with Cypress and, like, opening up for them. And, you know, he's really... He's really, you know, he's a kid from Philly, you know, out here just trying to make it. So, you know, that's why that's how he got on. And then eventually, you know, he started traveling with me and we got really tight and close. So we trusted his creative process.
What's the creative process like with you and B-Real or with the Serial Killers music? Is this always you guys in the studio together or do you send tracks back and forth or how's it go?
We do both, man. We, you know, sometimes he's able to make it. Sometimes I'm able to make it, but wherever I am, I could work on it. So,
uh-huh.
You know, this album was done, you know, about 3-4 weeks. We nailed it. 7 songs, the EP, standalone project. We were in the studio knocking this out. I think the last couple songs were done where we had to sit them around because mm-hmm. Cypress just dropped Elephants on Acid.
Right.
So he had to go support that movement and that push. So, but it all came together. He made both things work.
Right. Yeah. When you get in the studio though, at this point in your life, like what is your actual creative process like? Because there's a lot of, you know, I see a lot of dudes go in the studio now where they're sort of punching in, just sort of making stuff up on the scene or anything. But I'm assuming you're actually like sitting there technical writing out some like complex ass lyrics and shit.
Well, I mean, I do still write, but I write differently.
Okay.
I write to be cohesive.
Uh-huh.
And I want everything to make sense and everything to have land the way I want it to land perfectly.
Right.
A lot of that is about writing the beat and staying in the pocket. And so sometimes I'll write like paragraphs or I'll write little pieces, but I won't sit out and write a whole song.
Okay.
In one sitting. Like I'll take bits and pieces, and when I find a piece that I really, really like, then I'll find a way to kind of clip it and groom it so they can connect to another piece that I really like.
So are you sort of, you're still constructing when you're in the booth?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Absolutely. So I'll go in with an idea or I go in with a few lines written. And then when I got that, I'll listen back to it. And then I know what to say on the next line.
Yeah, that's fire. Do you spend much time touring at this point? Or
no.
Is that something you want to get back into with the new project and everything? Because Cypress is so out here and shit.
I do. I have not done any shows in quite some time. And I've been really enjoying it.
Well, it's just stressful being on the road and shit, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's just tough being away from your family, man. You know, and, you know, I'm not 20 anymore, you know, so I think that in order for me to go back on the road, I had to go do this kind of reinvention of myself and reinvention of me as an entrepreneur, reinvention of all that so I could change the narrative.
Mm.
I don't want to go out and have these promoters thinking that they can offer me motherfucking nothing, you know what I'm saying, to come out there and do what they know brings value
right.
and what they know brings a crowd, you know. It shit ain't bad for me anymore. You know what I'm saying? So I don't have to fucking come outside unless I want to.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Were you ever at that point where like, damn, I got to make some money, so I got to go do some bullshit ass tour.
Yes. Yeah.
That's got to be kind of a dark place to be in.
It is. And it is. With something that you used to love so much and look forward to doing so much, now you have to do it or else shit gets turned off.
Because you could go do exhibit in Dusseldorf, Germany.
Yeah, for fucking ever.
Crazy, yeah.
Forever,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And keep going through the Chitlin' Circuit.
Right, okay.
But, you know, I wanted something different.
Right.
And so in order for me to change it, I had to stop. And that means stop everything.
Right.
And so now we've built it up to a place where not only do we feel comfortable, but I'm really excited about putting this music out that we have, and not just for me. I'm excited about the whole label. Open Bar Entertainment has been something I've been doing since 1995, 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I finally coming to a place where not only is it, you know, financially sound, but it's also got a team of people around it that want to see it do well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are pushing towards that. This is our first endeavor, putting out something through the label with the Serial Killers Project. Mm-hmm. Then we've not just going to stay in music. We've developed a show, a series called Broken Ground, that we're going to reintroduce, you know, some artists through that as well. And then on top of that, we have a new artist we signed from Albuquerque, New Mexico. His name is Ben Shelton,
okay.
Like Mercedes Benz, B-E-N-Z-S-H-E-L-T-O-N.
Okay.
You know, and it's pretty crazy what we have on the calendar, man. So I'm excited about music again.
Yeah.
You know?
That's dope. Do you feel like, is it the fact that you're being successful in other areas and that you finally got like the tax situation, everything cleared away, that just has it so you're in this mental space where you can really embrace it?
Yeah, it is.
Is that a Brass Knuckles pen right there?
It is.
Oh, let me check that out.
Okay, yeah,
looks pretty good.
Yeah, hit that shit.
Perhaps I will.
Big clouds.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could turn your whole day around. is that coming handy? Because you're like forced to be doing stuff with the kids where you can't necessarily go and roll a whole blunt and stuff.
No, I'll smoke in front of a damn kid.
Oh, you smoke in front of
them. No, I'm kidding. You see them shits on the internet where people have like kids smoking weed and shit?
I heard that they went to jail for that.
Yeah, fuck yeah, they should go to jail for that.
I mean, a kid like smoking a blunt and really looking like he knows what he's doing.
Come
that's
on,
a
man.
Weird
that's
thing to
that's
see,
bullshit,
bro.
Man.
That's
Come
some
on,
crazy
man.
Shit.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, I got friends who smoke around their kids. And even for me, like, my parents would have never, like,
smoked
around me.
I go outside. I don't smoke anywhere in my house or any of that. I go outside. You know what I'm saying? But I'm not going to sit there with my 8-year-old just like, chief.
You don't, because you know he's just going to get
doing
curious.
Doing dabs and shit. Like, what the fuck are you doing, bro?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, because you know they're kids. They're going to get curious as fuck about it. You want to at least postpone that.
You know, and dabbing looks a lot like freebasing, so how the fuck are they supposed to know?
I still have that in my head when I see somebody taking a dab. I'm like, fucking crackhead.
Yeah, I can't do that shit. I will not get on nobody's rig, man. First of all, I don't know where your mouth been.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And then you got that crackish. Anything with a torch, crack. You know what I'm saying?
Like, well, you come from that era where that was more realistic.
That era. It's like, yo, man, I've seen motherfucking 40-50-year-old people begging kids for, please, let me get, please. Like, oh, man, I'm not fucking with that.
Oh, man, yeah. I don't know. Something about doing the dab where I just get a little too high.
Yeah, I just don't like it. I just can't fuck with it. And I know that's some people's thing. They live it. Well, it's pure. It's pure THC. That's the gateway drug.
Yeah, that's good for you. That's one way. I mean, I like it. I think it's cool. I've done it. If I really wanted to get like too high, I guess I could do that.
Yeah, but, do it, Dad, man. I mean, if you need all that, man, just move on to some other shit. Just get to the point.
Yeah. Were you ever on the other shit? You ever have real drug issues?
I've never done cocaine in my life.
Really?
Ever? I'll sell you some.
No.
But yeah. I won't do it.
Might need to. No. Coke. Leave Coke behind. 2018. That's a fact.
I've never. You know, that's one of the things that my father taught me. Like, you know, you're gonna go out and you're gonna have a lot of people that try to influence you to do other things, but never shoot anything in your vein. Mm. Never sniff nothing up your nose. Never ingest anything. You know, that is chemically based. You know, from somebody that you don't know. You know what I'm saying? And at all. Even if you know them. Like, they don't not your friend if they offer that to you.
You never took acid or anything?
No.
I would like to see an exhibit on acid.
In fact, my the artist, Benz, he does it all the time.
Really?
Yeah, and he tried to explain it to me. And I just have no desire.
Yeah.
I have no desire. He has a song called Free Your Mind that's all about that.
Right.
And he puts it in a perspective, and he described how it makes you feel and how you in touch with everything and you fucking can hear things and you understand things. And I was like, fuck that. I don't want to fight. I'm already crazy as it is. I don't need to go out of the shit that I'm already on. You know,
my thing with acid, a couple years ago, I felt kind of lost in terms of what I was doing. And I had a friend suggest it to me, and it just seemed like, you know what, I might need that right now. And I did it.
Yeah.
And somehow it just made me decide that I wanted to get my shit together. I know I say this as a grown man dressed up like Eminem for Halloween, but it made me really want to like get my life together and everything.
Yeah.
And I feel like it worked. But now I feel like I'm in a mental space where I know exactly what I want to do. And it's just an issue of working really hard.
Even after the acid wore off?
Yeah, you know, it made me really critical of myself, and it made me think about everything in my life and be like, you know what, you need to fix this, you need to get more serious about this, et cetera, et cetera. And now I feel like I'm in a position where I just need to work really hard to keep accomplishing things that I'm working on, and I have no desire to do anything like that, to get out of my current mind state. I feel like if I were to, I might get a little too far gone and be like, oh, let's go hang out on the beach for a couple weeks.
Well, you did acid, and I took depression. We got there.
In a long run, acid was kind of like a depression cure for me at that point, or at least like I felt like I didn't know what the fuck was going on in my life. You know,
I think what people don't realize is that life is about pits and valleys, highs and lows. Not everybody is living the way that they portray on Instagram.
That's
these,
a fact.
These smart, but nobody posts their losses.
Yeah.
Everybody posts when something is positive or they think is positive.
It's just offering this squeaky clean version of your life. And it's quite often not authentic.
Or screaming for attention.
Oh, that too, yeah.
You know, there's no happy medium. So I choose to, you know, like really embrace when I'm not doing well and not be afraid to share that.
Right.
Because I think when people keep putting up these, you know, these false images of themselves and trying to live up to this fucking hype, it does more damage to their real life than anything else they could be doing.
Right.
So I've learned to accept that. Not everything I do is perfect. Not everything I do is successful. But, you know, I see it as a chance to learn from my mistakes and do something better and move on from it, you know? The people that live that way are the happiest.
Right.
I found in my experience. So I try to live my life that way.
I feel like the issue is that for us, like, we're adults. We can look at some guy's Instagram who's like presenting his life in a certain light and trying to make his life seem so cool, and we can kind of see through it and be like, you know, whatever, he's capping, he's presenting himself in a certain way. But these young kids, if you're like 16 and you're looking at Instagram, it's like you really think that everybody's living this lifestyle on a day-to-day basis, and it makes you feel like a fucking loser because you don't have that. And I feel like that's the kind of unfortunate thing about social media, is that it presents everybody as if they're just totally happy.
The only one that's not faking it on Instagram is Dan
that's what I was thinking of. Yeah, but
fucking Dan, bro,
he's having parties with like 400 hot ass supermodels coming through.
Man, he's the only one that's not fronting for the gram. Okay, I think at any given point you could go ring his doorbell and that shit's popping.
I mean, you got to go watch his interview on Joe Rogan. He like really talks a lot about in depth about his life. And by that time, I always was kind of a hater on Dan Bilzerian, and then I watched this interview and I'm like, you know what? I can't hate on this guy. He's a cool dude.
Man, fuck, dude. He's the only one I think is not fronting for the gram. He does it. He does it big.
Who do you actually hang out with at this point in your life? Who's like the people that you actually associate with?
Man, I hang out with my OBE family, you know. I hang out with my family, you know. I don't hang out in clubs and do all that shit, you know. We've been doing a lot of promotion in Vegas. I had to go do a club that I was just showing up at, and it was like, I don't want to be here. You know what I'm saying? It's just
out of that mentality. I
like to create, you know, and I feel better when I'm in that environment. And so I don't really hang out with a lot of people. There's a lot of people that have been out of touch with me, especially in coming through a rough patch, man. You get to really see who your people are, you know? And so a lot of people wrote me off. A lot of people checked out. A lot of people was like distancing themselves from me.
Really?
And so I didn't get mad. I just like, okay, I took note of it. And so when things took the upswing, you should have seen them phone calls start coming in. You know what I'm saying? You should have seen them, you know, hey.
When they start seeing on the show and shit like that. Yeah.
How are you? Just checking in. Nah, fuck you.
Yeah, you know there's a lot of that.
Yeah, nah, fuck you. Just stay where you at. Keep what they say now. Keep that same energy.
Keep that same energy. Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, keep that same energy. And so I don't have no resentment. I don't have no anger. I'm over all that. You know, but I will do is I will respect their decisions, and I will keep them at the distance that they chose to keep, you know?
So yeah, Brass Knuckles. The Serial Killers Project. Anything else you want to make sure that the people are aware that you got coming?
Man, just, you know, I'm just thankful that they listening.
Yeah.
You know, the people that are listening, you know, and if you enjoy what you're doing, pass it on, you know, and keep an eye out for Open Bar Entertainment. We're doing a lot of powerful, creative things, innovative things, and we can't wait to share it with the world.
Hell yeah, man. Nah, it's just great to see somebody that I spent so much of my childhood looking at. Yeah. Just to see you in a really good state of mind is very, it's empowering.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
I am the real Shady.
Yeah.
You already know. My employee's just looking at me like, what the fuck? You can't believe I showed up like this today. All right, man. Hey, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for coming
thank
through.
Thank you, man. No problem, man. Every time.
No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world. Check us out on YouTube, possibly SoundCloud and iTunes. Coming back soon. Let us know if you want it. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Peace.
Shady Records. I'm